Is everybody more or less settled? I think I ought to start, really. I'm sorry about this. Seems to happen every week, really. Well, are there a lot of sleepy people in the audience? Who stayed up to watch the presidential election? Some people. Well, this lecture today is the third in this series of five. I have to apologize to anyone who has lured in under false pretenses, because originally I was going to talk about Europe and Asia, to talk about both simultaneously, but I don't think that's possible. So I'll be talking a bit about Asia in the last lecture of the series, and be talking today mainly about Europe and its position in the world, partly in relation to the United States and what happens next. I was also asked by lots of people before to stop early so that there can be a bit of discussion, so I'll try and shorten today's lecture so that leave at least 10 minutes or so for any comments that anyone would like to make, really, on any aspect of anything that I've talked about in the first few lectures so far. And there are two ways you could do that. If you want to write down questions and pass them down the front, I'll pick them up at the end and try and answer them, or otherwise just ask them verbally as we go along. Well, last time I talked to you, it was 6 days before the US presidential election. Now, as they say, it's the day after. And as we know, it's almost certain that George Bush has won another 4 years. I mean, as I said in my previous lecture, I was unashamedly, I suppose, a partisan for John Kerry, and I feel saddened for America, and I feel saddened for the world, because I think a John Kerry presidency would have made a difference for the reasons I outlined previously in both domestic policy and foreign policy. But it is not to be. It was a razor edge thing, like before, with almost a complete reproduction of the results previously. So I think my conclusion that the United States is a 50-50 society is actually borne out by the results, even though those results produce a continuing Republican dominance. Last time I told a joke about George Bush, I feel I'll even up a bit and just tell a joke about John Kerry, even as he disappears into history, seemingly disappears into history. Dick Cheney goes on this TV show and accuses John Kerry of being lacking in profound convictions. And later in the day, John Kerry hits back and says, "That's not quite the case." In other words, I think if Kerry had come out a bit more as a conviction politician, it might have just swayed the difference in the election result. Well, this time I'm going to talk primarily about Europe, and I think when you start out to talk about Europe and its place in the world, you can see there is a big difference between its presence and the presence of the United States. If I were to ask you who was the outgoing president of the United States and who is the current president of the United States after last night, assuming the results are still for Bush, everybody in the audience could tell me, and everyone in the world more or less could say. But supposing I ask you who was the outgoing president of the European Commission, and I might ask you who it was, if you put up your hand. So can you put up your hand who knows who was the outgoing president of the European Commission? Well, that's a relatively small proportion of the audience. It was Mr. Prodi, who came to lecture at the LSE quite recently, so you should know about him. And I was, there are not many jokes about Mr. Prodi, at least as European president of the European Commission. I was searching the internet to try to find a joke about Mr. Prodi, but I couldn't find any. Hands up, who knows the current president of the European Commission? Well, it's José Manuel Barroso. And although there might be jokes about him in his home country of Portugal, I couldn't find any jokes about him either as the president of the European Commission. And that says something, in a way, about the relationship between Europe and the United States in relation to world power. In his book that I mentioned previously, Timothy Garton-Ash just wrote this book called Free World, in which he went round the United States asking people what they thought of Europe. And he goes to somewhere in Missouri and asks people in the local town what they think of Europe, and the sort of the people he's asking kind of shuffle in an embarrassed way and kind of grin in an embarrassed way, and then eventually one of them says, well, I guess there's not much hunting down there. Which shows you that Europe does not have the global presence that the United States has. So you're dealing with two different centers, really, of world power with very different influence over them. Now, one of the themes that I've suggested in these lectures is the theme of the relationship between identity and emancipation. What I've been arguing is that we live in a world which is marked by the transformation of tradition, custom, something happening all over the world. We have a different relationship to time, we have a different relationship to the past than previous generations have had. And that relationship means that for all of us, we face much more open futures than before. We do, on an individual level, and on a global level, have more freedom than previous generations have had. We have a more open future. As individuals, as nations, as transnational organizations, we're less defined by the past than previous generations have been. But the other side of that is an identity crisis. The other side of that is the problem of finding what one's identity is. The problem of deciding on an individual level too, I think, who one is. What should I be? What should I aim for in life? What does it mean to be a woman? What does it mean to be a man in the contemporary world? These are much more open questions than they ever were before. Now, I've been trying to stress it in the global age. These run through a whole series of other issues which affect social institutions as well as individuals and their emotions. I said in the last lecture this is true of the United States, and it's manifestly true of the European Union. Europe has an identity crisis, not the same as the United States, but certainly identity crisis of what it is for, what it should be for in the future. And when you look at the question of Europe, you start out to discuss the question of Europe, I think it's pretty plain that what Europe started out as is not what Europe has to become. Europe, the European Union, post-war Europe, started essentially as a Cold War formation, like so many other things in the world. It began, as most people here will know, sort of in the mind of Robert Schuman and one of the two other visionaries who first established what was essentially an economic integration of Europe in the European steel and coal community. The original idea of Europe was to have a bit more pooling of economic markets in what was originally six countries, which originally constituted the foundation of the new Europe. And the original idea was to build on that economic integration something much more profound. That economic integration, as I said, started out with steel and coal, therefore was a relatively limited aspect of Europe and even Europe's economic identity. That became the European Economic Community, set up in 1958, and that endured the European Economic Community for several decades. But over that time, as everyone in the audience, I'm sure, will know, you had four progressive phases of expansion. So the European Union grew through 15 members to the 25 members that it now has. And the 25, the EU 25, like so many other things we're talking about in these lectures, essentially post 1989 formation, because it marks something really fundamental, I think, in spite of the sort of trite way in people reacted to it, the reunification of Europe, which was divided for such a long time after World War II. The original motivation of having an intensified identity for Europe underlying the formation of the EEC, I think there were plainly several linked motivations. There was the economic one. You get more economic weight if you pool your resources. There was, above all, the military one, because what those who founded the EEC originally wanted was to ensure that Europe would be a continent free from major war. Europe, of course, had been the site of two fantastic wars, both become global wars. And those who wanted to establish a new European identity wanted to ensure this would not happen again. This included Winston Churchill, who originally was favorable to the idea of the European integration and gave a famous speech about it not long after the war, and also, importantly, included the Americans. The idea of European identity has from the beginning been supported by almost all American administrations, who wanted distinct European identity, not just for the reasons I just mentioned, the economic reasons, the reason of avoiding past conflicts which have scarred the whole continent, but also because of a third reason, which was the Cold War. The United States supported European integration as a buffer between the US and the Soviet Union, as a way of containing communism. An enormous amount, really, about the history of Europe over the 30 or 40 years after that, you can explain in terms of Cold War polarity. This is true, for example, I think, of social democratic thinking, social democratic politics. The center-left, as it were, the kind of European social model developed over that period, but the European social model got its identity partly precisely from this Cold War polarization. It got its identity from being different from liberal American market capitalism and different from Soviet communism with its state-dominated economy on the other. The European model, European social democratic politics, very much defined pre-1989 by that kind of division. It inserted itself, as it were, ideologically in the middle of the other two frameworks of possibility. And when in 1989-1990 Soviet-style economy founded and disappeared, European leftism was also in a situation of not clearly knowing what its identity was, not clearly knowing what it should aim for. And many of the debates which I've been involved in politically attempt to find a new form of center-left which reacts to globalization, which is appropriate for dealing with this new global age in which we live. It's a struggle to redefine the left in a situation where it was no longer defined by this polarity, and where everybody has to recognize that markets and competitive markets must play a very significant role in producing an effective economy. So many of the dilemmas of the left and many of the possibilities of the left hinge very much on this sort of version of this process of emancipation, in this case, emancipation from Cold War dualism that did so much to structure Europe. Whatever Europe is now, like the United States, and I suggest in the last lecture, the difference between the United States and Europe in terms of identity is not so great, because the United States is not clear what the United States is anymore, whether it is a nation, whether it is a quasi-imperial system, as it has global spread, as its identity changes. Well, there's not that much difference, because the European Union has to make parallel shifts. Whatever the European is today, European Union is today, as I'll come on to a second, it plainly has to be defined as a response to the global age, as a response to globalizing processes, no longer as a Cold War formation getting its identity between the two different sides within which it was sandwiched. Now, it's often thought at the contemporary time that the European Union and European identity are under enormous strain, under enormous pressure, that the very process of the transformation of 1989 and the Cold War has left the European project foundering. And if you look at the statistics, they do tend to support that, or prima facie, they seem to support that. For example, only about 25% of the population in the new East European members of the EU actually voted in the last election. It is quite extraordinary, given what seems to me to be the world historical significance of the reunification of Europe. It's as if once you've got something, you no longer value it. Once you've got something, you no longer, you lose sort of the dramatic significance of it. And if you look at approval ratings of the European Union, there's an organization called Eurobarometer, which regularly publishes surveys about what people think about Europe. If you look at the most recent surveys, you find some countries, such as Spain, Italy, Portugal, Greece, where over 50% of the population still give positive appraisal of the European Union. If you ask them, do they think of the European Union positively, about 58% of the population in those countries say they do. But you look at other countries, and you find that proportion is shifting fairly markedly downwards. It's well under 50% in France. It's under 40%, actually, in the last Eurobarometer survey of Germany. And I mean, you know, you're sitting here in the UK, you can guess where Britain stands in this hierarchy, can't you? Only 23% of the British population think of the EU positively in the last Eurobarometer poll. While the whole lot has kind of been shifting downwards, and the UK has always been at the bottom in these surveys which have been carried on for the last two or three decades. But very small, you know, relatively small proportion of the population now endorse something which is changing all our lives, because, you know, there's no mistaking the impact of the European Union on Britain. Most of the legislation which affects this country now is actually European legislation. It has shifted the structure of sovereignty. That's what the Eurosceptics, of course, don't like, but it is a pretty fundamental change in the nature of the country and its relationship to the world. And it is sort of amazing that somehow this country has always been what many people define as the reluctant Europeans. Always going along, but, you know, going along with grudges, going along kind of mumbling about it, going along swearing about it, but at the still time seemingly wanting, you know, to be a free rider, to get the advantages of the European Union, but at the same time to grumble about it, at the same time to disapprove it, at the same time to constantly hover about the possibility of even withdrawing from it. No clearer definition of a free rider than that, I think. And the UK has been a kind of free rider on Europe. Even its contributions, as Mrs. Thatcher, have not been commensurate to its population or its economic weight. The UK hovers right at the bottom of these ratings. So the European Union, if you look at statistics, seems to be in a certain amount of trouble. And there are structural reasons for this, which I'll come on to in a minute. But there is another point of view. And that point of view has recently been expressed quite eloquently. Can't find anything to write on. By an author called Jeremy Rifkin, who just wrote this book called The European Dream. Jeremy Rifkin, The European Dream. And Rifkin argues that the United States has been carried along by the American dream. The American dream is an energizing dream of the nature of America. It's the thing that you think of when you pass the Statue of Liberty, when you come into the United States in New York, so you come on a boat. It's an energizing dream of a society which is free and open, where people can find their own place in that society, no matter what background they come from. But Rifkin argues the American dream is dying. The American dream is dying because it's not appropriate, he says, to contemporary globalized conditions of interdependence. The American dream stresses individualism. The American dream, George Bush will forgive me, was a sort of cowboy mentality. In this case, you know, Rifkin says it's a kind of positive idea of individualism in America. That Europeans think of a cowboy president as being a rather disastrous thing, but Americans quite often think of the cowboy, as I think many people in Europe used to do 20 or 30 years ago, as somebody who's free, who lives a free life, who's on the frontier, who's able to precisely kind of create a new life for themselves. But Rifkin says this kind of dream is too individualistic. It's too materialistic. It's linked to economic success primarily. It's linked to social mobility. And Rifkin says quite rightly, it's a myth that the United States is a more open society than other industrial countries are. It's not. And all the studies of social mobility show this. Although there is a strong ideology of freedom and mobility, if you look at the actual statistics of social mobility, the United States actually has less mobility than some European countries do, both in terms of career mobility and mobility across the generations. So countries like Sweden, for example, most of the Scandinavian countries have more chance of someone from a poorer background getting to a decent position in the society than it's true of the United States. So Rifkin says, well, this dream does not really match up to reality. It's also a dream that exists with a kind of dominance of American power in the world that we talked about last time, which Rifkin says is not really a sustainable form of power in the world. United States, he says, and I think this is more or less right, is kind of holding the world to ransom in a certain way. Its voters are over two issues. The issue of Israel, where it's very hard for an American president to move and create a more harmonious society in the Middle East, which surely the rest of the world wants and needs. And second, on ecological issues, because it's extremely difficult for any American president to endorse a rise in gas prices or to change the relatively profligate use of energy, which distinguishes the position of the United States ecologically in the world. So he says this is not a sustainable dream, and it's not a generalizable dream. So although you might quite rightly, I think, say it's a good thing to want to spread democracy across the world, it's a very good thing, and we should want to do that, to spread, as it were, the American way of life across the world is not, he says, a sustainable thing. Then he thinks Europe, well, the European dream is different, because the European dream, it emphasizes interdependence. What's the nature of the European Union? Well, it's pretty different from, for example, the United Nations. The United Nations, which is valued, I think, by everybody, is still an association of nation states. It gives primacy to sovereignty. But sovereignty no longer can determine our reactions to some of the core questions in our world. Therefore, European Union is offering something different, where states for the first time have got together to pool their sovereignty in order to do things collectively which they can't do alone, including among those things to find a position in the world for this emerging identity of the European Union. And Rifkin also says, I mean, I have to say, I think his book is not a great book. In other words, it's much too favorable to Europe, I think, for reasons I'll come on to a bit later. But it's an interesting reversal of the normal thesis. He said economically, it's normally assumed the United States is a long way ahead of Europe. And it is in terms of growth rates, something I'll also come back to. It is. But if you look at productivity, quite a few European countries are more productive per worker than the United States is. And what Europe has done is kind of negotiated a freer life, he says, because Europeans work much less than Americans do. In several EU countries, they're more productive, but rather than choosing to work all the time and drive GDP endlessly up, they choose, in a certain sense, to have more free time, to have more leisure time, to have more holidays, and have a different style of life, a slower style of life, if you like, than the United States has. And he says also, you look at the European Union, it's endorsed transnational international law. It's enshrined a version of international law into its own Euro legal institutions. The United States still refuses, seemingly, to sign up to the idea, effectively, of international law with teeth. And he says the European Union is much more ecologically sensitive than the United States is in terms of its policies. It's sort of built in commitment to ecological policies, not just by signing up to Kyoto, but in the actual framework of some aspects of what the European Union actually is. So he says there is a new dream there, as it were, and that dream is a dream of an interdependent world in which nations can coexist harmoniously and in which we can build upon that interdependence to create a more pacific and economically sustainable form of life than the United States represents. So there is a counter view, and that counter view, whatever the faults of the book, are expressed, I think, with considerable force by Rifkin. Now, very quickly, when you look at the position of the European Union, I want to suggest to you that there are sort of four main questions that we have to try to discuss, and I will try to buzz through them fairly quickly, even though they're all very important ones, so as to leave time for this famous discussion and debate. First of all, we have to answer the question, what actually is the identity of the European Union? What is the European Union? What should be its identity? What kind of animal, really, is the European Union? Second, I think we have to ask again the question, what is it for? Because what the European Union was for in the Cold War period cannot be exactly the same as what the European Union is for in the contemporary globalizing world. Third, we have to ask, what are its main weaknesses? And these weaknesses, I think, are considerably more extensive than Rifkin tends to imply, and some other supporters of the European Union tend to imply. And fourthly, we have to ask, come back to the question of the US, should the EU have geopolitical ambitions? And if so, what should these geopolitical ambitions be, and how can Europe sustain them? All big questions, so all I can offer are sort of variety of my own comments on how to resolve them. If you turn first to the question of identity, continuing kind of issue for Europe, but one which, as I've said, emerges differently post-1989. What should Europe be? How should we think of Europe? I think there are only three ways in which you could answer this question. There are only three versions of what European identity could be. One is what the Tory party in this country wants Europe to be. You could think of Europe as simply a free trade area, analogous to the free trade area of the Americas, for example, analogous to NAFTA, which involves the United States, Mexico, Canada, some other countries, a pure trading zone with no further integration. Well, I think my view on this is that no one really who looks at Europe seriously can sustain this, because the European Union is already way beyond being simply a free trade area. It's impossible, I think, to see that it could go back to being simply one, because it has much higher levels of economic integration, and it's developed much more of a single marketplace, than far more than is in the case of NAFTA, which doesn't have the same mechanisms at all. So I don't think it's feasible to suppose that the European Union could revert to such a structure, and I certainly don't think it, my own view is that it would be desirable that it should do so. The second vision is the traditional vision of Europe, really, the vision of Europe as a federal system. And this idea of Europe is very much bound up with the original members of the European Union, some of whom wanted to see Europe as a counterbalance to American power, who wanted Europe to be as important in world society as the United States is, and saw Europe as a kind of power center, able to challenge the United States. The federal view of Europe would place a lot of emphasis on the idea of Europe, in other words, European culture, European identity, in some sense, central to what Europe is. It would suggest that you have mechanisms of integration which would parallel those of the American Constitution, and quite a few Federalists have seen the American Constitution as their model, really, for the emergence of the United States of Europe. The best latter-day version of a federal model of Europe was that given by Joschka Fischer, who also, as you know, as I mentioned last time, visited the LSE recently, about 10 days ago, and the German foreign minister, who about 4 or 5 years ago gave a famous speech arguing that the way forward for Europe has to be federalist. But I think even Joschka Fischer is now largely, as I understand it anyway, abandon this view in the way in which he first proposed it. And I think that the weight of opinion in Europe is moving towards a third position, which seems to me to be the only feasible one. I don't think you can sustain the idea of a federal Europe, certainly not in the short term, when Europe has expanded to 25 nations, those 25 nations possibly expanding to some 40 nations in another 10 to 15 years' time, where those nations will never be, I think, like states of the United States, where they will continue to be substantially sovereign nations in spite of having surrendered considerable chunks of their sovereignty to the EU. So I think we should see the EU as a postmodern device, a postmodern system which is neither a traditional state nor simply a free market area, which is pioneering something new in world society. And that something new is essentially, I think, the sharing of sovereignty and the disciplinary mechanisms of political advance of democracy, economic advance of competitive markets, and human advance of human rights, which goes along with the accession criteria into the European Union. European Union, for me, therefore, has no fixed identity. I'm not sure it should have a fixed boundary either. I'm not sure there should be finality to the European Union. I see the European Union as a kind of move towards a segment, if you like, of world government, but are situated in a particular part of the world rather than aspiring to be a genuine world government, but a new form of mechanism of sovereignty, new form of relationship between nations. For that reason, I don't know what people in the audience feel, but for that reason, I strongly supported the acceptance of Turkey as an accession country in the European Union. That decision still has to be ratified by the European leaders in about a month's time. It's been accepted in principle by the European Commission. It's dividing Europe. There are many people on the left who are hostile to Turkey being part of the European Union because big countries, poor country, predominantly Muslim country. Those who are critical argue, well, it's on the edges of Europe rather than being central to the European experience. But I, myself, I hold very strongly the opposite view. I think it's crucial that Turkey does become an accession country. It's crucial for especially geopolitical reasons, which I'll come on to towards the end of what I have to say. I think Europe should aspire to be a significant geopolitical actor in the world. It's not enough, you know, to have a world where no one makes jokes about Romano Prodi. We want a European leader who is sufficiently prominent in world society for people to see that there is power there. And where there is power, you're going to make jokes about the person. Joking is a kind of reflection of the significance, as I said before, of a leader in world society. I think we should aspire to have that for the European Union. I don't think the European Union can have that if it shirks the geopolitical significance of accepting Turkey as an accession country. Not the same as accepting Turkey immediately, of course, into the European Union, since even those who are most favourable to this process say that it can't happen before at the earliest 2015 or something like that. But it is a major commitment to an incipient process of democratisation, economic advance in a crucial corner of the world. So my view is that it's strongly, very strongly supportive of this position. Which means that you probably don't have finality to Europe because you don't have to consider what other countries should be accepted within the European Union, which again would transform the identity of what Europe should become. So I see European identity partly as a process, not as a fixed geographical or cultural identity in the way in which the federalists want to have it. Secondly, well, I'm never going to leave time for discussion. I just don't seem capable of it. But why should the European Union continue to exist? It's important, I think, to ask the question because of the sort of rising tide of Euroscepticism, but I want to answer it very quickly, really, because I want to come on to sort of concluding part of the meat of the lecture about the geopolitical role, really, of Europe. I think the reasons are overwhelmingly powerful as to why the EU exists. It exists above all because of the pooling of sovereignty that I just mentioned. It exists because of the economic power that it gives individual nations. The European Union nations trade with one another. They are not, as I said, just a free trade zone. They are economically strongly integrated. Well, over 40% of the trade of this country, the United Kingdom, is with the other EU countries, and the same thing is true in reverse. The economic reasons are very powerful for further expanding and integrating the single market in Europe. The civilizational reasons are very powerful. Look what happened in Spain, look what happened in Portugal, look what happened in Greece. Those were countries which had dictatorships. You might assume the history of Europe has been the history of democracy, but this is not completely true. Those countries had military dictatorships and were relatively poor only some 3 or 4 decades ago. The accession criteria has been a civilizing process for those states, as is happening in the East European countries too. And that civilizing process happens before you become a member, not just after you become a member. Look at the progress of Spain, which is completely amazing. Could not have happened without the European Union. Look at the progress of Ireland, the most competitive country, it's said, now in world society. Could not have happened without the European Union. The civilizational aspect of the European Union is surely crucial to what it exists for. But it also exists, I think, for the prevention of war. There are those who say that now we're no longer in a Cold War period, you know, nations are not going to fight one another anyway, and there is some truth in this. Nevertheless, we don't know what would happen in Europe if Europe broke up into a whole aggregate of nation states again. It's not the risk, I think, historically, which Europe should take. The European Union is and has played a role. It certainly didn't prevent Bosnia, it didn't prevent internal wars, but it has prevented major wars between nations. They have become largely unthinkable. This is not just because of overall global integration, it is because of the very existence of the European Union itself. But the European Union does have weaknesses, which Rifkin doesn't, I think, discuss effectively. These weaknesses, I think, are fairly well known, and they're part and parcel, really, of some of the rise of Euroscepticism over the last 10 to 20 years. There is the legendary weakness of the democratic deficit of European Parliament and European transnational institutions. Should we be worried about this? Well, we certainly should be worried about it in terms of how the electorates think about it. But I'm very sympathetic to those who say that actually what the European Union is doing is pioneering a form of democratization above the level of the nation, certainly is, and that in some respects this form of democratization is actually more democratic, not less democratic, than the individual nations. The reason being that democracy is not just how you vote and who you vote for, democracy is also how you reach agreement. Whether you reach agreement through public discussion, whether you reach agreement through negotiation, or whether you simply reach agreement through power. And what happens in most nations is that many agreements are reached through power, but in the European Union they cannot be. You have to reach decisions through negotiation. You have to reach decisions through an open consensus. You have to reach decisions through transparent consensus too. So whatever the scandals that have existed in the European Union, it is, I think, arguably creating a form of democratization which in some respects could be said to be actively even more democratic than those of its component nations, whatever the problems of legitimacy that go along with that structure. There are, of course, problems of foreign policy in Europe. As the famous Henry Kissinger question, who would he telephone in a situation of global crisis because Europe has no single foreign policy leader? Well, it does have one in a way, at least now, and that foreign policy leader, again, is visiting the United States, visiting the LSE next week. It's Javier Solana, and he's coming, I think, next Thursday to a thing that I'm chairing here. And he's the person that you would phone. No one could say Europe has an integrated foreign policy, but it certainly has an individual to whom one can turn and to whom the various component national leaders turn in situations of economic crisis. The big problems of Europe, it seems to me, the big reason for the declining legitimacy of Europe are not primarily to do with those issues. They're not primarily to do with democracy. They're not primarily to do with foreign policy. They're primarily economic. And this is where I quite substantially disagree with Rifkin, because I think the problems of the European Union are strongly related to its lack of economic dynamism, its lack of overall economic competitiveness, the sluggish nature of economic growth in its core economy, Germany. One of the main problems for Europe is that growth is very slow in Germany, but Germany is the motor. The German economy is easily the biggest economy, is the motor of the European Union. It's not easy to deal with a national issue when it affects a transnational organization like the European Union. The European Union has a major demographic crisis, which I'm sure most people here will know. If you look at the demographic profile of the EU countries and you compare it with the United States, even more so, what I was going to do in this lecture, with India or with China, the difference is quite staggering. India and China, and the United States too, have a vibrant younger generation. In the United States, this is largely because of legalization of originally mass illegal immigration into the US. The United States has a lot of young people coming into the economy. The European Union does not. Birth rate in the European Union on average is only about 1.7, and in some countries, like in Spain or Italy, the birth rate is down to 1.2, the lowest birth rate ever known, actually, in human history, nowhere near close to replacement rate. So it's not surprising. Europe has a massive pensions crisis, a very big older generation with no one in the younger generation to pay for them, but who still expect to be supported by the state. But more importantly, it's hard to see where the economic dynamism will come from, which will regenerate economic growth in Europe. And without Europe performing economically for its constituent nations, it's hard to see that it will recapture the kind of legitimacy that it should have. So I think a great deal of Europe's problems actually do come back to its economic position and its lack of dynamism. And I did bring one or two figures on this. If you look at the period 1990 to 2001, over that period, the GDP of China grew by 226%, 1990-2001, the US by 85%, and the EU by only 15%. It's a very, very massive differential, and I think people sense that in their relationship to what the European Union is. Finally, in a way most importantly, what should the geopolitical role of Europe be? And here we again have to consider, now there is a Republican administration in the United States, some key figures of which have expressed enormous reservations about Europe, who seemingly want Europe to be divided rather than integrated, as all previous American administrations wanted the continent to be, who see Europe as weak and see the United States as strong. What kind of geopolitical role can Europe forge for itself? Well, here again, I think there are three and only three possibilities. First of all, you could have what I would define as sleepy Europe. Sleepy Europe would be Europe turned in on itself. Sleepy Europe would be Europe which refuses any effective geopolitical role, partly because it refuses any kind of expenditure on military capability, and partly because it simply wants to turn away from the wider problems of the world. What did the vote in Madrid mean after the Madrid bombings, when the government of Aznar was thrown out and a new socialist government elected? Did it mean that Europeans want to shirk their wider responsibilities? Did it mean they want an easy life? Did it mean that they want to somehow separate themselves from the broader problems of the world? If they do, they have to be sure this is not an option. Sleepy Europe is not an option, because there are forces out there. And I'm going to discuss them next time. By the way, I hope everyone will come next time. I'll be talking about global terrorism. There are forces out there which will not allow Europe simply to be sleepy Europe. Europe, incidentally, imports more of its oil from the Middle East than the United States does. So it's heavily dependent upon geopolitical stability in that area, which is, however, not in a position to guarantee. Second version of Europe, which at one time was very appealing to me, and I think is the Rifkin sort of version, I would describe as easy multilateralism. Easy multilateralism. I won't bother to write it on this device. Easy multilateralism is the idea that Europe can export its model to the rest of the world. What has Europe created? It's created, I've suggested, a kind of postmodern identity around the pooling of sovereignty, and based on the idea that we live in a much more interdependent world, and this is the process whereby we can accommodate to that world. It's quite a seductive idea to say, well, Europe can generalize this model to the rest of the world, just in the way in which the United States seeks to generalize its model to the rest of the world. Maybe other parts of the world can also pool sovereignty. Maybe they can kind of copy the European Union. And therefore, the European Union will have a civilizing role in geopolitics because others will accept it as its model. I no longer think this is an option, although I did used to think that this was the way in which one should think of Europe. Mainly because of Robert Kagan-type arguments, mainly because the rest of the world is not like that. In many parts of the rest of the world, you're dealing with nations, sometimes aggressive nations, sometimes failing states, sometimes rogue nations, a world of power where military force cannot be ignored. So I think there is only one way forward for Europe to sustain a geopolitical role, and that is through what I define, if you'll forgive the term, as hard-nosed multilateralism. Europe, I think, should stand for a multilateral world. It's not a sign of weakness to say that the world is interdependent. It's not a sign of weakness to say that we need collaboration of nations across the world to resolve the world problems. We do need such collaboration. It's not a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of absence of power. But it is not enough. Europe must be able to back up its involvements in the wider world society by the use of force when that use of force is necessary. And it will always be debatable when it was necessary. Was it necessary in Kosovo? It was certainly used in Kosovo. But in Kosovo, the Europeans could not manage without Americans. At the moment, Europe is not able to play this role because it cannot manage without America. As I think I mentioned last time, Europe has a whole morass of troops under arms. A whole morass of troops in the European countries. But it can't shift these troops anywhere. It doesn't have the logistical capability to mount rapid reaction outside of the European continent. But if you don't have that, and if you're not prepared to endorse that and spend money on that, if you're not prepared to have greater military integration, Europe will not be able to be the geopolitical actor, which I think it quite rightly should aspire to be. But Europe, therefore, must make progress on having more independent military presence, which to back up its multilateral position in the world. And that way, I think, which will be discussed by Solana when he comes here in a week's time, is the way for Europe really to sustain itself in the world, for Europe to become known in the world, and for us to have a lot of great jokes about Romano Prodi. Thanks very much. I'm sorry not to have finished to allow discussion. Thank you. Next time, global terrorism.